for the Rosary is requested as a reading tonight. We read from Judges chapter 11, beginning at verse 29 and reading through the end of the chapter. Judges 11, beginning at verse 29. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed over Gilead and Manasseh, and passed over Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed over unto the children of Ammon. And Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord, and said, If thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into mine hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. So Jephthah passed over unto the children of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord delivered them into his hands. And he smote them from Aroer, even till thou come up to Minnith, even 20 cities, and unto the plain of the vineyards with a very great slaughter. Thus the children of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. And Jephthah came to Mizpah unto his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with timbrels and dances, and she was his only child. Beside her he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass, when he saw her, that he rent his clothes and said, Alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low. Thou art one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back. She said unto him, My father, if thou hast opened thy mouth unto the Lord, do to me according to that which hath proceeded out of thy mouth. For as much as the Lord has taken vengeance for thee of thine enemies, even of the children of Ammon. And she said unto her father, Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go up and down upon the mountains, and bewail my virginity, I and my fellows. And he said, Go. And he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her companions and bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. And it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow which he had vowed. She knew no man. And it was a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in a year. And I'll give our attention to Brother Roger.
Well, the study this evening is entitled Jephthah's Daughter, Death or Dedication. And I suppose in one of these sort of subjects like this, it's long been known that there are different views in the Brotherhood, and so I hasten to say at the start, as I said last night, let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. And what I'm going to do tonight is present to you what I believe is the best answer to the conundrum, but am happy to remain in fellowship with someone who has a different view at the conclusion of the meeting, given, thankfully, that it's not a fundamental matter. And so it's one of those things where different brethren have come to different conclusions, and maybe we will never resolve the conundrum this side of the kingdom. Maybe we'll have to ask Jephthah in the kingdom in order to find out once and for all. But I think one of the objectives we have in solving Bible problems is to try and find the Bible solution that best reconciles the most biblical issues surrounding the problem. So what we're trying to do is to find a solution that harmonises the most things that are brought to bear in that particular issue. And I do have a view, and it's based on the fact that I think that this view answers more questions than the other view. That the other view leaves more conundrums, it actually leaves more problems than it supposedly solves. And maybe my opening comment was significant because I think crucial to this whole particular question is what we make of Jephthah himself and what sort of man we think he was. And you notice I started by saying that maybe we'll have to ask Jephthah in the kingdom. Now, why would I say that? Because, well, because he's mentioned in Hebrews 11, isn't he, in the honour roll of the faithful. Time would fail me to tell of Gideon and of Jephthah also. And so Jephthah is recorded for us as a man of faith and as a man of faithfulness. And I think that's an important thing for us to remember in deciding the nature and the scope of Jephthah's vow. In fact, I think it's crucial to what we make of Jephthah's vow, is perhaps our determination as to the quality and character of the man himself. So let me present the two basic views that are in the Brotherhood to start with, and then I'll say immediately what I think, so that you can be put out of your misery and I don't keep you in suspense till the end. But having made a stake, the position, what we're then going to do is spend some time exploring and enjoying the analysis of Scripture that might lead to that particular conclusion. And remember, as I've said, I fully understand that someone else may have a different view based on a different set of scriptural passages. And that's the other thing, I suppose, that comes out of this type of study, is it all depends on what weight we give to what parts of the text. People may give different weights to different points as being weightier or more important. Somehow we've got to be as fair and as balanced as we can be in giving due weight to all of the factors that might be brought to bear. So here's the two fundamental views concerning the question of Jephthah's daughter in Judges chapter 11. The first view is that the daughter was really sacrificed, and that when Jephthah vowed his vow in Judges 11 verses 30 and 31, that this was a rash vow uttered in the heat and extremity of the moment before battle. As the record says, he was in the thick of battle at the time, and in that distress that he found himself in, he offers a vow that turns out to be rash as time unfolds. And the second part to that idea is that the vow made, verse 31, I will surely offer it up for a burnt offering, clearly implies death, and that it is based, in fact, on the vow of Leviticus chapters 27, verses 28 to 29, which you don't need to turn up now because we're going to turn it up later on, but Leviticus 27, verses 28 and 29 speak about things that are devoted that shall be surely put to death. And so it's been suggested that the vow here does involve the actual death of the daughter. And that thirdly, in verse 35, the grief of Jephthah is because of the extremity of the vow that he's made and the terrible consequence that will ensue as a result with the loss of his daughter in death. And in verse 39, finally, the fourth point is that the terms of verse 39 certainly imply that he carried out the vow exactly as he had made it. And if he had made that rash vow, that would in fact result in her death, that the scripture is quite clear in recording that nevertheless the vow was carried out by Jephthah as he had vowed. Now that's slightly brief, as both of these will be, but it's an essential summary of the line of argument that's followed concerning the fact that the daughter died. Actually, I'll rephrase that. That the daughter died as a result of Jephthah's vow. Because as we discussed on the way home from our trip this afternoon, we're all in fellowship on the matter that Jephthah's daughter died. Just a question of when and for what reason. Now, the second view is that the daughter was dedicated to Yahweh's sacrifice. And that line of argument says something different about verse 31, which is that the idea of the burnt offering implies actually the principle or the spirit of dedication, which is what the burnt offering stands for. And secondly, that Jephthah's vow was not rash in intent at all, but based in fact on Leviticus 27, on some earlier verses which do talk about the vowing of people and don't necessitate the fact that those people had to die. And that thirdly, in verse 35, Jephthah's grief will be answered by the fact of his daughter's perpetual dedication, which is what he had vowed, and that finally, in verse 37 and verse 38, the daughter bewails her virginity and not, in fact, her impending death. So that's a brief summation of the two lines of argument, if you like. Now, my personal view, so I'll say it right at the start, is that I believe the daughter was dedicated and not killed. And we're going to look tonight at the reasons why I think that's a more scriptural conclusion to come to. And perhaps we ought to start, as we said earlier, is that crucial, I think, to our understanding and assessment of the vow made in this chapter is our assessment of Jephthah as a man himself. Given that we already know he's a man of faith and found in the honour roll of Hebrews chapter 11. So here's the first thing, verse 30 of Judges 11. The suggestion is made that this was a rash and foolish vow made in the moment of excitement as he was caught up in the drama and the worry of impending battle, and that through the pressure of circumstances that came upon him, he makes a vow that subsequently turns out to be rather unfortunate. Well, I think that the answer to that is that I don't think that's how Jephthah appears to us in the divine record at all. If you come back to earlier on in this chapter, we're told this in terms of the circumstances of how Jephthah's character is revealed. In chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "Now Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor. He was a man of courage as well as a man of faith. He wasn't a shy man, he wasn't a timid man, he wasn't an uncertain man. He was a man of valor," as the record says. But he was more than a man of valor. Because if you come to verse 7, it says, "And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, Did not ye hate me and expel me out of my father's house? And why are ye now come unto me now when ye are in distress?" This when they have come and said to him, "Come be our captain that we may fight with the children of Ammon." So Jephthah is not a man that grasps at sudden fame or notoriety. When he's asked to assume the responsibility of captaincy, he doesn't say, "Yes, I'll do that." He says, "Well, let's stop and talk about this. Weren't you the ones that expelled me? Why would you come to talk to me now?" By the way, I think Jephthah was already warring against the Ammonites personally. I think he was already involved in his own combat against the Ammonites as a matter of faithful activity on his behalf. And now that others come to make him captain, he's not the sort of man that rashly decides to assume that responsibility, at least not with further careful checking and investigation. Now we know that because you see what verse 9 says. They said, "Look, we're in trouble, we're in distress, help us." And he says in verse 9, well, he says, "If you bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon and Yahweh deliver them before me, shall I be your head? What will be the terms of this relationship? How certain can I be of what you have undertaken and promised here?" This doesn't read like a man of rashness, does it? It reads like a man who's careful and deliberate in his dealings. Verse 11 says, "Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and captain over them. And Jephthah uttered all his words, but he did so before Yahweh in Mizpah," says the record. So here's a man that commits himself to Almighty God in terms of the responsibility that he decides to accept. He's a careful man, he's a faithful man, he's a mighty man of valour, and we don't see any particular spirit of rashness in him as this record unfolds. More so as the record continues, because what's he been asked to do? He's been asked to lead them in battle against whom? Against the Ammonites. So what's the first thing he does? Verse 12. Jephthah sent messengers unto the king of the children of Ammon, saying, "What hast thou to do with me?" So before he engages in war, he seeks reconciliation. He seeks to sort the matter out in a non-combative manner. Instead of simply going to war because he's been asked to do so, he says, "Let's see if we can sort this issue out by means of negotiation and sensible discussion." And the king replies, and we're told again, aren't we, in verse 14, it says, "And Jephthah sent messengers again unto the king of the children of Ammon. For a second time he endeavours to reconcile before going to war." Brothers and sisters, this is not a hasty man. Absolutely not a hasty man. In fact, quite the reverse. He's very measured and very deliberate in his dealings, and he has committed himself to Yahweh in this matter before proceeding. Now, what's interesting about the speech of Jephthah that starts from verse 15 onwards, right through to verse 27, is that there are apparently, and I haven't counted these up exactly, but apparently 20 references to Scripture in his appeal, including a notable set of references from Numbers 20 and 21 and Deuteronomy chapters 1 and 2 from the story of the journey of Israel up through this very territory in previous times. Jephthah is a man of Scripture. His argument is based on Scripture. He quotes Scripture 20 times in his letter, in his appeal to the king of Ammon before going into battle. This is a man who thinks spiritually. He's not just a mighty man of valor who goes into battle without thought. He's a spiritual man who commits his way to God and who acts accordingly. Now, not only that, but when we come to the actual vow he makes, do you notice what it says? It says at the end of verse 29, right at the end of the verse, that from Mizpah of Gilead he passed over unto the children of Ammon. And verse 30 says, Jephthah vowed a vow unto Yahweh and said, and now he makes his vow. And then verse 32 says, so Jephthah passed over unto the children of Ammon to fight against them. Now, when you read the end of verse 29 and the start of verse 32 carefully, you will come to the conclusion that the vow he makes is not at the battle. It's not when he's in front of the children of Ammon. It's back in Mizpah before he crosses over to meet the children of Ammon. This is not a vow made in the heat of the moment as the battle begins. It's a vow made before he crosses over to see them. And I think that that vow was made in the carefulness that characterizes all of Jephthah's actions, and not in fact in haste at all. And the last thing to notice about the vow is, when does he make this vow? Verse 29, immediately after the Spirit of the Lord has come upon him. So he's just had the Spirit of Yahweh come upon him when he makes this vow. Now, given all of those circumstances, would you think that that vow is likely to be a rash vow or a careful and considered vow by a man who's noted for his scriptural knowledge already in the record, and upon whom the Spirit has been seen to come, and who has already carefully endeavoured to reconcile before battle on two separate occasions before he proceeds further? I don't think this was a rash vow. I think this is a man who knew exactly what he had done. So let's come now to the vow itself from verse 30. So the record says, Jephthah vowed a vow unto Yahweh and said, if thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into mine hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be Yahweh's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. And sometimes the suggestion is made is that what happened, of course, is that Jephthah expected an animal to come forth from his household, and that the reason why he was undone by his daughter appearing is he thought an animal would come forward, and he'd always intended right from the start that he would offer that animal as a burnt offering. Well, I'm actually not sure that that's the case at all. I don't think Jephthah intended that an animal would be the offered item. I think there's three reasons for that. In fact, four reasons. The first is that to offer simply something that came out of the door was hardly special. He's vowing a vow to God saying, if you will deliver me in this battle, then I will vow this vow. Now, to simply say, well, whatever comes out the door I'll kill, is hardly a special vow to God, is it? Not even knowing what it might be. That's the first thing. To vow whatever might come was hardly special, even if it was an animal. The second thing is that Jephthah surely would offer the best. If this was a singular vow to God, to plead God's favour, he'd want to offer the best, and no doubt the best that the law provided. And the third thing is that the first animal that might have come out of this house might have been a family dog. How would he know? It seems rather haphazard, doesn't it? It might have been a dog. Would Yahweh delight in the offering of a dog upon the altar? No, I don't think so. And yet Jephthah had no control over that if it was an animal that he intended. Now, what's interesting about the word whatsoever in verse 31 is this. In the margin it says, that which cometh forth. But many translations render the word whatsoever as whosoever or whoever. And Kyle and Delitzsch say, now you know who Kyle and Delitzsch are? So Kyle and Delitzsch is a notable Old Testament exposition by some German authorities, but their particular strength is the Hebrew text itself. And Kyle and Delitzsch say that the phrase cometh forth to meet in the Hebrew, cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet, that phrase cometh forth to meet in the Hebrew is only ever applied to men and not animals elsewhere. It's only ever applied to people and never to animals elsewhere. So what would it mean in Judges 11? And the answer is, I think, exactly the same. I believe that Jephthah fully expected that someone would come forth from the house. He was expecting a person to come out of the house. And if he was expecting a person right from the beginning, then that has important consequences for deciding what it might have been that he was vowing. You've got to think about this. If he fully expected that some person was going to come out of the house, then what do you think he would vow concerning that particular person? Now, here's the next issue. The suggestion is that the terms of the vow, verse 31, definitely require human sacrifice. Whosoever comes out of the doors of my house shall be Yahweh's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Well, firstly, the law of burnt offerings in Leviticus 1 naturally never suggested humans. And not only that, but what it did say, Leviticus 1 verse 3, is that if you were ever to offer a burnt offering, it had to be a male. It had to be a male. So to imagine that a female, even of the human variety, would be acceptable as a burnt offering is strange, because the law did not provide for a female burnt offering. The law said it must be a male if it's to be burnt. And in fact, of course, what the law expressly did forbid was the burning of children. Now, let's just look at two or three passages concerning this. Why is this relevant? Because Jephthah, as we've already seen, was a man with a particular knowledge of the scriptures. In fact, I go further and say a particular expertise in the book of the law. Jephthah's quotations are from the book of the law. He knows this book. Well, this is what the book said. Leviticus 18, verse 21. And thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Molech, neither shalt thou profane the name of God. Thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Molech. Leviticus 18, verse 21. Again, in Leviticus 20, verses 2 and 3. Again, thou shalt say to the children of Israel, whosoever he be of the children of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth any of his seed unto Molech, he shall surely be put to death. And the people of the land shall stone him with stones. And I will set my face against that man, and will cut him off from among the people, because he's given of his seed unto Molech to defile my sanctuary, and to profane my holy name. And again, in Deuteronomy chapter 12, we're told, in verses 29 to 32, the record says, when Yahweh thy God shall cut off the nations from before thee, whither thou goest to possess them, and thou succeedest them and dwellest in their land, take heed to thyself that thou be not snared by following them, after that they be destroyed from before thee, and that thou inquire not after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. Thou shalt not so do unto Yahweh thy God, for every abomination to Yahweh, which he hateth, have they done unto their gods, for even their sons and their daughters have they burned in the fire to their gods. What things soever I command you, observe to do it. Thou shalt not add thereto, nor diminish from it. Now, brothers and sisters, the book of the law was absolutely clear that the burning of children as unto Molech was an abomination to God, who abhorred that practice of the Gentiles absolutely and totally. Question. Why would Jephthah make a vow which was a clear violation of God's scripture as the basis for claiming God's help in battle. Why would he make a vow which was a deliberate violation of God's scripture to then ask for God's help in success in a particular battle? I personally think that that does a grave injustice to the integrity of the man himself. And here's another thought for you. Leviticus 1 verse 7 says that burnt offerings could only be offered by the priest on Yahweh's altar. Tell me what priest would have consented to literally crucify, sacrifice, and dismember Jephthah's daughter and offer it on Yahweh's altar and thereby defile the sanctuary with an abomination to God? What priest would have done that, even for Jephthah, on Yahweh's altar? And here, brothers and sisters, is one of the things that I think personally is what I would call a clincher. You know what a clincher is? Now, two hands. Make sure you're back in Judges 11. So Judges 11 verses 30 and 31. And without looking at it, just turn up in your right hand 1 Kings chapter 11. So find the 1 Kings chapter 11 in your right hand. Don't look at it. Just find it. Put your hand in it, close it, and come back to Judges 11. Right, have you got Judges 11? Good, now you can look at 1 Kings 11. Now, this is what it says. Verse 7. 1 Kings 11, verse 7. Then did Solomon build an high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem. Notice these words carefully. And for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. So whose God was Molech's? The Ammonites. And what did they do to Molech? They burned their children with fire unto him. Now come back to Jephthah's vow and think about this. Judges 11, verse 30. And Jephthah vowed a vow. Now read it carefully. He vowed a vow unto Yahweh and said, if thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into mine hands, then it shall be that whosoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, I'll burn them alive. Now why on earth would Jephthah offer to burn alive a child or a person in thankfulness to God at the defeat of the nation that burns their children alive, that's an abomination to God because they do so? Can you follow the logic of that vow? I can't, brothers and sisters. I can't imagine how Jephthah could possibly have made that vow. That's utterly inconsistent. He's asking for help in battle to destroy the very nation that burned their children with fire, and his offer would be that he burn one of his instead? I don't think so. I don't think there's any logic to that whatsoever. And Jeremiah chapter 32, which you don't need to turn up, but Jeremiah chapter 32 says in verse 35, and they build the valley, the high places of Baal, which are in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to cause their sons and daughters to pass through the fire unto Molech, which I commanded them not, neither came it even into my mind that they should do this abomination. In Jeremiah chapter 32, verse 35. No, I do not think that Jephthah would have vowed a vow as utterly inconsistent as that, as to offer to do the very thing that the nation that he was about to destroy with God's strength did, which was so abhorrent to God himself. Now then the next suggestion, coming back to Judges 11, is, and now we need to turn up to turn up Leviticus chapter 27. So we need Judges 11 and Leviticus chapter 27. The next suggestion that's made, and it's quite an interesting point, is that Jephthah's vow was actually going to be a fulfillment of the terms of Leviticus 27, verses 28 and 29. And at first sight, when you read these verses, you think, well, maybe that's so, and therefore maybe there was a vow unto death. So let's see, first of all, what Leviticus said. Verse 27. Notwithstanding, no devoted thing that a man shall devote unto Yahweh of all that he hath, both of man and beast, and of the field of his possession, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy unto Yahweh. None devoted which shall be devoted of men shall be redeemed, but shall surely be put to death. And so the suggestion is made, this is what Jephthah did. He devoted whoever it was, as it turned out to be his daughter, to death in the terms of Leviticus 27, verses 28 and 29. Well, I don't think so. And I'll tell you why. Because we're not told that Jephthah made a devotion. We're told he made a vow. And the two terms are quite different. The term vow is neter, and the term devotion is kerem. And Jephthah vowed a vow, he did not vow a kerem. Now, if you come back to Leviticus chapter 27 and verses 1 to 8, we do have the vow concerning persons. And I think that this is the particular vow, in fact, that Jephthah made. And this is what the record says. In Leviticus chapter 27, verses 1 to 8, we have the vowing of persons. And it says this: Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When a man shall make a singular vow, the word means a wonderful vow, a great vow, in fact, a difficult vow. When a man shall make a difficult vow, the persons shall be for Yahweh by thy estimation. And thy estimation shall be of the male from 20 years old even unto 60 years old, even thy estimation shall be 50 shekels of silver after the shekel of the sanctuary. And if it be a female, then 30 shekels, and if from 5 years to 20, then the estimation shall be. And so it goes down, all of these estimations of value. Now, this section in Leviticus 27, brothers and sisters, is actually saying this, that a person could be vowed to God, but then redeemed back for the payment of the value that the law specified. So if we take verse 3, for example, a male from 20 years old to 60 years old had an estimated value of 50 shekels. So if a person, for example, vowed one of their servants, they could then buy back that servant by the payment of 50 shekels to Yahweh's service. But it was also possible that a person could be vowed and not paid for. Now, what would happen if a person was vowed and not paid for? And the answer is, well, in that case, they would belong to God without the right of redemption. And I think that's the singular or difficult vow mentioned in verse 2. A difficult vow, because it was the specialness of, in fact, devoting a person to lifelong service and dedication to God in some capacity. And I think that's exactly what Jephthah vowed. He vowed the vowing of a person and agreed to forfeit the right of redemption so that that person would never be redeemed. Now, that vow in the start of Leviticus 27 is absolutely different to the thing devoted in verses 28 and 29. Now, the verses in verses 28 and 29 mean literally, that word devote means literally to utterly destroy. And if you go through Scripture, you'll find that the only people that were ever devoted to death were the enemies of Israel. The only people that had a kerem pronounced against them of devotion to death were the enemies of Israel. There was no basis for a kerem for the devoting of faithful people. And in fact, we're told in Numbers 18, verses 14 to 17, that even those who had been devoted in Israel belonged to the high priest and his family. Now, for example, there's no point under the law. You stop and think about it. It can't mean, can it, in Leviticus 27, that a man could decide, well, I think I might devote my servant to God so that he can be put to death. That's not what that was about. Leviticus 27 was about the absolute dedication of those things that would be put to death because they were the enemies of God. A person couldn't use the law of Karen to kill off someone in Israel that they didn't particularly like. But what they could do is vow the vow of Leviticus 27 verses 1 to 8 to vow a person absolutely to the service of God with no right of redemption in their lifetime. Now come back to Judges chapter 11, and now let's look at that vow again in a little more detail with regard to what then might have been said and what might have been happening here. Because it says, and it's been pointed out, well, it does say in Judges 11 verse 31 that it expressly says that the person was to be offered up for a burnt offering. Well, that's where it gets quite of the Hebrew of verse 31. Because the words at the end of the verse, "and I will offer it up for a burnt offering," all of those words in the Hebrew, well, there's only two words in the Hebrew that cover that entire phrase, only two Hebrew words. "And I will offer it up for a burnt offering," only two Hebrew words. The interlinear translation translates it this way: "And I will offer it instead of a burnt offering." And the suggestion, therefore, the suggestion taking that translation is that the person was being offered to God as totally dedicated to him, which is what the burnt offering symbolized. I'll offer the person instead of a burnt offering, but under the principle of absolute dedication to God, which the burnt offering symbolized. But the treasury of scriptural knowledge says something else. The treasury of scriptural knowledge says that the phrase "wahalatu olah," which is the Hebrew phrase here, "I'll offer it up for a burnt offering," "wahalatu olah" means, literally, according to the treasury, "I will offer him a burnt offering." And the "him" makes reference to the person to whom the sacrifice was to be made, rather than the thing that was to be sacrificed. In other words, I'll offer to God, I'll offer to him a burnt offering. Now, to make it even more interesting, the word "for" in that verse, or in that phrase, is not there in the Hebrew. So we shouldn't read, "I will offer it up," or "I will offer him up for a burnt offering." That word's not there. So in other words, it should just read, "I will offer up a burnt offering." It might read, "I will offer him up a burnt offering," but "I will offer up a burnt offering." Now, when you read that, I think that what conclusion we come to is that what Jephthah was vowing was that whoever came out of the doors of the house, he had a person in mind all along, shall be surely Yahweh's, and I will offer a burnt offering. So there would be a vow and a burnt offering. Now, have a look at these passages that show exactly that idea, a vow and a burnt offering. In Psalm 66, we're told this in the 13th verse. Psalm 66 in verse 13 says, "I will go into thy house with burnt offerings, I will pay thee my vows." Psalm 66 verse 13. So there is a vow and the payment of that vow, and there is a burnt offering. What was the payment of Jephthah's vow? A person was going to be vowed without right of redemption. And associated with the vow and of that person, he was going to offer a burnt offering. Which, of course, by the way, the burnt offering symbolized what? If there were two things, what did the burnt offering symbolize in the case of Jephthah's daughter? It symbolized the offering of her. The offering of the animal was symbolic that she was to be absolutely dedicated. And the vow and the burnt offering were seen side by side. Do you remember, if you come back to Numbers 6, which is the law of the Nazarite, do you remember what happened at the completion of a Nazarite vow? We're told in Numbers 6, verses 13 and 14, this is the law of the Nazarite when the days of his separation are fulfilled. In other words, he's completing his vow. He shall be brought unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and he shall offer his offering unto Yahweh, one he lamb of the first year without blemish, for a burnt offering. So the Nazarite came with his completed vow and with a burnt offering, side by side, the vow and the offering together. Have a look at this one, which is extremely interesting in the light of what we're talking about, in the 1st of Samuel chapter 1. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 1, we're told in verse 11 of chapter 1, it says that Hannah vowed a vow and said, O Yahweh of armies, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man child, then I will give him unto Yahweh all the days of his life. By the way, what was she doing? She was making the vow of a person without right of redemption, wasn't she? She was vowing him without ever having the chance to buy him back. That's exactly, I think, the vow that Jephthah made. Now look what she does in fulfillment of that vow. Verse 24 of the 1st of Samuel chapter 1. And when she weaned him, by the way, do you know when they weaned children at that time?
2 years old.
Yeah, I would go for three, because there are two or three references that suggest 3 years of age. When she'd weaned him, she took him up with her with three bullocks. But in the Hebrew, I understand that it says a bullock of 3 years, one ephah of flour, a bottle of wine, brought him unto the house of Yahweh in Shiloh, and the child was young. Now look at this, verse 25. And they slew the bullock, it's a definite article, it's the one bullock of 3 years old that she bore, and brought the child to Eli. Ooh, do you see the parallel? See, the child's 3 years old. She offers as a burnt offering a bullock of 3 years old, which will be offered as a burnt offering, and she brings the child and gives him to Eli. That's the vow. The vow and the burnt offering side by side. And the offering of that bullock as a burnt offering was symbolic of the dedication of the little boy who was about to be given to the service of the tabernacle without the mother ever having the right of redemption. I think that's exactly what's going on in the occasion of Jephthah's vow. And lastly, in Numbers chapter 15, we're told something similar. In Numbers 15 and verse 8 it says, and when thou preparest a bullock for a burnt offering or for a sacrifice in performing a vow, says the Lord. A burnt offering of a bullock in performing a vow. So along would come a person who vowed a vow, and they would complete or fulfill their vow and offer a burnt offering simultaneously at the same time. I think that is precisely what is happening in the book of Judges in chapter 11, and that in fact that's what the text means. Whosoever comes out of the house shall be Yahweh's. He's vowed without right of redemption, or she's vowed without right of redemption, and I will offer a burnt offering. And the burnt offering was symbolic of that person who now had been wholly and utterly dedicated to Yahweh's service in that way. Now come back to Judges in chapter 11 then, and let's just notice one or two other things. By the way, we don't need to turn this one up, but we're told in Jeremiah chapter 44, verses 25 to 27, is that when Israel made illegal vows, God wasn't prepared to accept them. And yet we're told in Judges 11, verse 32, that as soon as Jephthah makes his vow, Jephthah passes over unto the children of Ammon to fight against them, and Yahweh did deliver them into his hands. So presumably Yahweh accepted Jephthah's vow. And yet Jeremiah 44 says that God would not accept illegal vows made by his people. And yet he answers the prayer of Jephthah and delivers the Ammonites into his hands. So come now to verse 35 of Judges 11. Verse 34 may be for connection. Jephthah came to Mizpah unto his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with timbrels and with dancers, and she was his only child. Besides, he had neither son nor daughter. Beside her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass when he saw her that he rent his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low, and thou art one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth unto Yahweh, and I cannot go back. Now, just hold your hand in Judges and come back to a couple of references in the book of the law. Firstly, Numbers 30, verse 2. Alas, my daughter, I have opened my mouth unto Yahweh, and I cannot go back. Where does Jephthah get that from? Well, you see what it says in Numbers 30 and verse 2. It says, if a man vow a vow unto Yahweh, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do all according to, or he shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. I have opened my mouth unto Yahweh. I cannot go back, says Jephthah. That's the book of the law. Numbers 30, verse 2. When a man made a vow, he couldn't go back. And by the way, notice what the margin says in Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man made a vow, why, see Leviticus chapter 27, verse 2. The vowing of a singular vow to offer a person without right of redemption. That's the cross-reference in the margin. And here's the second quotation. Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verses 21 to 23. Deuteronomy 23 verses 21 to 23. And that passage says, when thou shalt vow a vow unto Yahweh thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it, for Yahweh thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee. But if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee. That which is gone out of thy lips thou shalt keep and perform, even a freewill offering according as thou hast vowed unto Yahweh thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth. And Jephthah says, alas, I've opened my mouth, I cannot go back. You see, Jephthah's words come straight from the book of the law, Numbers 30 verse 2, and Deuteronomy chapter 23 verses 21 to 23. This is a man who's got intimate knowledge of the law of his God, and that very law expressly forbade the offering of anybody in burnt sacrifice. I don't think that that man, who knew this law so well, would ever have made that vow. So what did he mean in verse 35 then of Judges 11 when he talks about the grief? If his daughter was never to die, if she was simply to be devoted to Yahweh, what an honourable thing. Well, yes. But think of the consequences. And there were two consequences that would have caused genuine grief to Jephthah in the fact that his daughter was the first to come out of the house. The first point of grief is this. This is his only child, and now they will be separated for the rest of their lives. Or he can visit her at the tabernacle where she probably was. But the flower, the apple of his eye, has gone from his house for good. I can assure you that any father would feel that grief. And not only is she his only child, and will now be separated from him because of her dedication, which he has vowed for her. But as a result of the vow that he's made, she will never marry. And therefore she will never bear children. And his own house will be extinguished. Because he has no other children. And the name of Jephthah's family wouldn't even survive through a daughter in any way, shape or form. His house would be extinguished in Israel. That was a matter of special grief for any man who held an inheritance in the land of Israel. So that vow of vowing his daughter in permanent dedication without the right of redemption was certainly a singular matter of grief to this man who had made this vow. And now we come to verse 36, and to the remarkable spirit of the daughter, which says, and she said unto him, my father, if thou hast opened thy mouth unto Yahweh to do to me according to that which has proceeded out of thy mouth, forasmuch as Yahweh hath taken vengeance for thee of thine enemies, even of the children of Ammon. And she said unto her father, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go up and down upon the mountains and bewail my virginity, I and my fellows. Now, this is a very strange verse, isn't it? As soon as the vow of her father is mentioned to his daughter, what's the one thing she wishes to do? She wishes to bewail her virginity. Why? Why does she want to bewail that? Well, because the principle of the whole burnt offering was dedication in perpetuity. And therefore, the whole of her life had to be dedicated, including that part that might once have been offered to a husband and to a family. She will never have that. She will never have married life. She will never bear children. She will never have a family. Her vow will take her to the tabernacle and to the service of the high priest. But she will be effectively a widow as a result of her vow. And she bewailed, as any woman in Israel would bewail, the fact that she could never ever bear a child. And this, the nation from whom the promised Messiah would come. Every daughter in Israel wanted to bear children because of the promise of the coming seed of the woman. And this she could not do. Now, you see what it says in verse 38. You've got to stop and think about this in terms of the logic of it. Because, you see, it says, he said go. And he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her companions and bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. Now, brothers and sisters, if purely the matter of her life had been in question, those tears could have been shed at home, couldn't they? She could have cried at home. But her lamentations concerned her virginity, and modesty required solitude for that particular grief to be uttered. She needed to be alone to bewail the loss of her womanhood in that sense. But the peculiar thing about all of this is that the bewailing of her virginity is out of keeping with her impending death, if that's what was really about to happen to her. You see, I believe that to mourn one's virginity in this passage does not mean to mourn because one has to die a virgin. She was mourning because she would have to live as a virgin. And that was a burden she would bear for the rest of her life. And that 2 months' respite, therefore, is understandable. But to think that she should only think of bewailing her virginity when her impending death is looming seems absolutely unaccountable, doesn't it? Why would she not bewail her impending death? Why only her virginity? And in fact, I think that's the key, inasmuch as history in these two verses lays such special emphasis on her bewailing of her virginity that must have stood in some peculiar relation to the nature of the vow. The matter of her virginity stood in some peculiar nature to the relation of her vow. And given that her vow was to one of lifelong and personal dedication to the truth, then we understand why that was the case. Now, you see what verse 39 says in fulfillment and in corroboration of that. Verse 39 says, it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow, which he had vowed, colon, and she knew no man. Now that statement, by the way, and she knew no man, adds nothing at death that hasn't already been told us. We've been told she's a virgin. But the fact that he fulfilled his vow was fulfilled inasmuch as for the rest of her life she knew no man, which is the proof that he had done with her according to his vow, and that the vow had been fulfilled, and the proof that he had done it, and that he had dedicated her life to God as a spiritual offering in lifelong chastity lies in the statement at the end of the verse, and she knew no man. Here is the proof that the vow had been performed. She would hitherto be dedicated to Yahweh's service and would never know man in that sense and never raise child. Now, let me just give you two or three passages with relationship to this that you might find interesting. I've got no idea, by the way, by the chairman of when I started, so please let me know when you would like me to cease. and unless and until you do so, I shall continue on. Now, in Ezekiel, in Exodus chapter 38, we're told this. Exodus 38, just a little string of references that I find helpful concerning what might have been going on here. Firstly, Exodus 38, verse 8. Verse 8? No, it's not verse 18. Yes, it is verse 8. It says, "And he made the laver of brass, and the foot of it of brass, of the looking glasses, of the women assembling, which assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation." Do you notice that? So there were women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. We're not told that what they were there for, but just that there were women that assembled in that way. And presumably it's those same women that were assembling, not same women, but the same idea, in the 1st of Samuel chapter 2 and verse 22, when it says about the woman that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation in Eli's time, in the time of his sons. And I think that these were spiritually minded women who attended on the service of the tabernacle. Now, you notice what it says in Luke chapter 2. Why would we go to Luke 2? Remember the famous person of Luke 2? Now, see what it says about Anna. In Luke 2, it says this, does it not? Verse 36. "And there was one Anna, a prophetess, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was of a great age and had lived with her husband 7 years from her virginity." And that's an interesting phrase in this context, isn't it? From her virginity. "But she was a widow of about 84 years. So what had happened is this woman had been married only briefly for 7 years. Her husband had died. And what had she decided to do? To devote herself, as if she was still a virgin, to the service of Yahweh's sanctuary. And she did so for the rest of her life. And now she's a great age, but she has served in the sanctuary. She'd only been married for a very brief period of time. And instead of marrying again, instead of taking another husband and raising a family, she made the decision that she would commit herself to the matters of the temple and to serve in God with fasting and prayers day and night." Right? She's very similar in spirit, therefore, to what was happening, I think, with Jephthah's daughter. In Numbers chapter 31, we're told this. There's two more references, and then we'll come back to Judges. Numbers 31 says this. Actually, I've got three more references. Numbers 31 and verse 30 says, "And of the children of Israel's half, thou shalt take one portion of 50 of the persons, of the beeves, of the asses, of the flocks, of all manner of beasts, and give them unto the Levites, which keep the charge of the tabernacle of Yahweh." And then it says in verse 40, "And the persons were 16,000, of which Yahweh's tribute was 32 persons. And then it says in verse 47, "Even of the children of Israel's half, Moses took one portion of 50, both of man and beast, and gave them unto the Levites, which kept the charge of the tabernacle." So there were people given to the Levites to help in the matter of keeping the charge of the tabernacle. They served the Levites. They served the priests. I think that's what Anna was doing, and I think that's where Jephthah's daughter went. I think she went to the tabernacle of the congregation to be in service to Eli and the priestly household. And she was a virgin there. Now, two more references, one of which you don't need to turn up because I'll read it for you, but it's Lamentations chapter 1, verse 4. And Lamentations 1, verse 4 says, "At the time of the calamity of the overthrow of the city, it says, the ways of Zion do mourn, because none come to her solemn feasts. All her gates are desolate." Now, listen to these words. "Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted." Lamentations 1, verse 4. And lastly, you might like to take a reference of 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 34 that says this. "There is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman," in other words, the virgin, careth for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. Now, isn't that interesting? The virgin cares for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. I think that's exactly the sense in which Jephthah's daughter was dedicated. She would be a virgin in service at the sanctuary, so that she might concentrate without distraction on the matters of God and on the matters of his service. Now come back to Judges in chapter 11. And let's just finish off the story in terms of what the record says. So in Judges 11, we're told this. Firstly, you notice what it says at the end of verse 39. It was a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in a year. By the way, interestingly enough, the margin says they went to talk with the daughter of Jephthah. Did you notice that? They went to talk with the daughter of Jephthah 4 days in a year. Now, presumably they could only do that if she was still alive, of course. Now, I'm not sure about that, Hebrew. I haven't been able to check that out, but I just draw that to your attention. The marginal reference suggests that that is possibly the meaning of the phrase, not to lament, but to talk with. But whether or not that is so, notice that there is no censure of Jephthah in all of the story. For example, if you go back to chapter 9, verses 56 and 57, and by the way, this is only illustrative of a number of these passages, particularly in the book of Judges, where we know there's great wickedness. Verse 56 of Judges 9 says, "Thus God rendered the wickedness of Abimelech, which he did unto his father, in slaying his 70 brethren, and all the evil of the men of Shechem did God render upon their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham." And so when a person did something that was wrong in the eyes of God in the book of Judges, they are brought under censure in the divine record. There's not a word of censure about Jephthah, is there? He performed his vow, they lamented her, and there's nothing more said about Jephthah that in any way what he had done was wrong or inappropriate or incurred the divine condemnation or judgment. And I think, brothers and sisters, the reason why it didn't is because there was nothing wrong with the vow. He had dedicated his daughter in that way to sacrifice. By the way, of course, this all begs the question, doesn't it? The burning question. I think that what's interesting about that is that I think the house he was in at the time was his father's house. It may not have even been at the time he went to battle that his daughter was there. And you remember at the start of the story that his brethren expelled him from his father's house. And as a consequence of this recovery, I believe that he was back in his father's house, and that who he expected to come forth was the oldest brother of the house, the head of all the brethren that had expelled him and dealt with him unjustly, and that it was the full intention of Jephthah on return from the victory of battle that he would dedicate his own brother in service to God, without the right of redemption, as an object lesson to all of that family that they had not been committed to the ways of Yahweh. Because they expelled him, he went and warred against the Ammonites, they did not have the faith to do battle against the Ammonites themselves. And as an object lesson and dedication to the father, I think it was the intention of Jephthah that the eldest son would probably come out of the house as representative of the head of the house to greet him on his return. But instead, unbeknownst to him, his daughter was there. The vow was undone, at least as to his intention. Now, one last thing, which I cannot prove, but I have heard suggested. You'd need to check the chronology for this. But if it's true, brothers and sisters, it would be one of the most unbelievable stories in the Bible. And also an example of the unbelievable mercy and wisdom of God. But I have heard it said that there is a possibility that at the time, Jephthah's daughter was a very, very old woman. A little boy was brought to the sanctuary and devoted by his mother without the right of redemption and that little boy arrived at the tabernacle, ostensibly under the care of Eli. But there was an old lady there, into whose charge the little boy might have been given. And that before she died, Jephthah's daughter may have seen Samuel and had charge over him as the child that she could never have. Now, I don't know whether that's right, because you'd have to check the chronology. But if it was, then that would be the sort of thing that we would expect of God, wouldn't we? That at the last, he would make the matter right and reward the faithfulness of that woman, the fact that she had never expected. So be that as it may, I think that the daughter's faithfulness is an illustration of the spirit of her father. This was a faithful family through and through, and the submission and obedience of the daughter is a match to the faith and courage of the father, and that this vow all along was never a vow of death or destruction, both of which were repugnant to God, but rather of positive offering to Yahweh's service, which she gladly did in fulfillment of her father's vow and for the great victory which he'd won for Israel at that time. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind.
I'm not exactly sure if it's in my jurisdiction at this point. Certainly up to Brother Roger, if anyone has any questions or comments. I think this is more an open type of class. Am I correct in that, Brother Roger?
Absolutely.
Okay. I don't want to overstep my bound.
Why do you think it was 2 months? Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I've got no idea. Got any ideas?
I don't. No. I couldn't think of why 2 months. I don't know where else that time period would show up.
You thought on 2 months?
60 days was a period for, I think it's 12.
I don't know.
Days of purification.
It's two cycles. Not just two cycles of time, but 2 months, which would also be two cycles of womanhood, wouldn't it? Any other thoughts? Well, that's the only thought that I've got, is that it represents a cycle of two times, and two times a woman's cycle, a thing doubled. That's somehow related to her bewailing of the child she could never bear during that particular time, doubled for her grief. But I've got no other ideas. Sorry? I wouldn't have thought so. He was a Gileadite. So I wouldn't have imagined that he was a priest specifically.
The question I have about that question that he
Sorry?
Then he did a broken
arm. Yeah, but when it says that he would offer a burnt offering, he would take it to the sanctuary to be offered, which was at Shiloh at that time, where the tabernacle was.
So he didn't do it.
No, so they would. When he says, "I will offer a burnt offering," what he means is, "I'll make one," but you had to go and take it to the priest, in fact, to be made. Yes. How it's read is that he had committed himself to offering as a burnt offering whatever first came out of the house. And that he expected an animal, but that turned out to be a person, and worst of all, it turned out to be his daughter. And that the terminology of verse 31 requires that that thing be offered up as a burnt offering. And then, of course, once you've come to that conclusion, then when it says, and he performed, unto her, according to his vow, what she vowed, then you read that the same way as well, don't you, at the end of the story, because you've already decided it was a vow to kill, so then you have to conclude that to do it unto her as he vowed means, will he therefore kill her, because you've decided that was the vow. If, however, you decide that the vow was dedication, then you still read the end bit the same, but now the performance of the vows is to perform the giving of her in dedication. Yeah, so I think the first thing is that the conclusion is based on the fact that the way they read the text, they believe it implies death. And the general argument that I've heard is the one expressed out of Leviticus 27, that it was a devoted thing, and it was devoted to death. Now, as I say, the reason why I'm pretty wary about that argument is because clearly that law could have been open to abuse, couldn't it? The person could decide to devote someone any time they liked, and that meant that person had to die. And by the way, how would Yahweh be honoured in that if people were devoted to be killed? I mean, that's not what God wants. He clearly says it elsewhere in the law, that's not satisfactory. And in fact, what it says in Numbers 18, which we didn't turn up, is this. Everything devoted, same word, in Israel shall be thine, God says to the high priest in Numbers 18. Everything that opens the flesh, the matrix of the flesh, which they shall bring unto Yahweh, whether it be men or beasts, shall be thine. Nevertheless, the firstborn of man thou shalt redeem, the firstling of unclean beasts thou shalt redeem, those that are redeemed from a month old shalt thou redeem, but the firstling of a cow, sheep, goat thou shalt not redeem, thou shalt sprinkle their blood upon the altar and burn their fat for an offering. So certain animals were to be burnt, the others were to be redeemed for use in other ways. Now clearly the persons that were devoted to the high priest, there's no way they were going to be killed. I mean, it just wasn't going to happen. But the things that were devoted to the destruction of death were, and that's the same word in Joshua 7, when the whole, you know, of Jericho was made a devoted thing to Yahweh. Yes, it was devoted to destruction because it was Yahweh's enemy. So essentially, it's really based on how they read verse 31. And as I've said, the thing with verse 31 of Judges 11 is there is quite considerable doubt about the meaning of the text. And I think that other solution is contextually much better anyway, because he says, it shall belong to Yahweh, it shall be Yahweh's. If it was an animal, of course it would be sacrificed. If it was a person...
Except if it was unclean. If it was unclean, you redeemed it.
If it was unclean, you redeemed it.
Human beings are unclean animals.
That's right. So the human and the unclean beast was to be redeemed.
Unclean animals are not welcome.
And
that's kind of the point too.
Yeah.
My thought was, if you know, God is very specific about what He accepts on the altar.
That's right.
And to say whatever,
that's right.
as you mentioned, a dog or,
yeah.
or whatever,
yeah.
a whatever doesn't seem to fit the requirements of Yahweh.
One thing all depends upon another. You see, so you have a vow that vows that whatever comes out of the house, he will offer for death or for sacrifice, followed by the unexpected thing coming out of the house. Or preceded by the fact that that's a rash vow uttered in the haste of the moment, you need all of that to come to the assumption you do.
Mm.
But the way the story unfolds, Jephthah doesn't come across like that sort of person at all. He's not like that. He's careful, he's thoughtful, he's religious, he's spiritual, he's scriptural in his reasoning, he's methodical. I don't think that... And as I say, coupled with the fact that the Spirit of God's just come upon him before he makes this vow, it seems incomprehensible. And to me, the clincher remains. He's defeating who? The very nation that offered their children by burning them with fire, so he would offer to burn one of his with fire, if God helps him, that just does not make sense. I think that actually does an injustice to Jephthah to ever imagine that he would have done that.
And as you read in Jeremiah, I think there's another reference saying that God, how God despised the animal sacrifice, and he says it never came into his mind. It never even came into his mind.
Human
sacrifice.
Yes. You said animal, but...
Oh, I did?
I think so.
Children.
Right.
But the flip side of that is, it did come into his mind, because that's exactly what he did with Isaac. That's exactly what he did with his son. Mm-hmm. But that's human sacrifice...
Per se. Yeah. You see, the sacrifice of Christ was a different thing altogether. Because this is really saying, and this is the point, isn't it, that somehow God would be pleased with the mere putting to death of a person for no other reason than we put him to death. That's what we mean by human sacrifice. The sacrificing of a person to appease an angry God. That was a pagan custom. The offering of Isaac as a precursor to the offering of the Lord was an entirely different matter, done to declare God's righteousness and not merely to appease an angry God. So on the face of it, it looks like simply human sacrifice, but clearly there are far more profound and deep lessons attached to the offering of Christ. But the sort of human sacrifice that's implicit in Jephthah's supposed vow is the very sacrifice that pagans would make. And that's what people are suggesting that he vowed. I mean, there was no other purpose to the death. What was there?
If you look at it in light of Christ's sacrifice, Jephthah's daughter, in parallel to Isaac and parallel to Christ's sacrifice, gives you another depth to it. Because you look at the sacrifice of Isaac from a Christian point of view, it's very, oh, he died to appease an angry God or whatever. But now you look at the Jephthah being dedicated. That's exactly what Christ was. His only son, his only daughter was given, totally dedicated to the will of the Father. And that's exactly what the daughter did. Dedicated to the will of her father.
Which didn't require her death.
Right, because right. Christ, and that exactly. Highlights the fact that Christ's sacrifice wasn't just
on Golgotha, exactly.
It was his life.
And in fact, the death of Christ was the culmination of a life of dedication that he had lived, if I can put it this way, as a virgin. So
sin never conceived in him.
Yeah. So as I say, the problem is it's quite possible that another brother could stand here in front of the Hudson Ecclesia and give an equally compelling address in the opposite direction. But in the end, it depends on what weight you give to what things. And what you've got to feel at the end is that you've given sufficient weight to sufficient matters in the text to do justice to as much as possible and say what is the best overall explanation of all these things. And I would still feel pretty comfortable that that sits, I think, better in the framework of the chapter.
It would seem to me, in order to prove that side, you would have to... my train just got derailed.
I can understand that.
You would have to examine the laws concerning a burnt... In other words, you'd have to look at the idea of burnt offering itself, in which I don't know how you could come to the conclusion that a human would be an acceptable burnt offering under the law.
Especially when the law expressly forbids it over and over and over again. And right. Everything we know, every time Jephthah opens his mouth, he quotes the law of Moses. He knows this inside out and back to front. Oh, well. So we're still in fellowship?